Hey, it's Francis Lam. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. You know, we hope you love the show and that you'll want more. Well, never fear. You can find more info on everything you hear at splendidtable.org. Recipes, videos, info on all of our guests and their books, and you can subscribe to our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about getting you delicious things to make on weeknights. But right now, here's this week's podcast. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I just Googled the phrase, tourist versus traveler. 30 million hits. That's 30 million posts on the internet that all say, basically, you know, that tourists go places to buy tacky souvenirs and take selfies, while travelers nobly go, you know, to really connect with a culture. It's not a really complicated distinction, but apparently it's one that a lot of people want to talk about. But what does that difference look like when you apply it to people who go far afield for food? Dr. Lucy Long teaches at Bowling Green State University and is director of the Center for Food and Culture, an independent nonprofit that promotes deeper understandings of food and how it connects everyone. And she has a way of distinguishing two kinds of eaters, travelers and pilgrims. Dr. Long talked with Emily Thomas from the BBC's Food Chain about why that difference matters.
I lived in Spain for a year. Part of what I was doing was studying the food culture. And people kept telling me that I needed to go to the north of Spain during a certain season and try their bean soups, and that every village had their own variety of bean, and they would make these into soup or stew. And people who were knowledgeable about this tradition, they could look at a bean and say, oh, that comes from this particular village. They'd spend a day, you know, maybe a weekend, traveling to these villages to eat these beans. So I did go to one or two restaurants and villages and try these. Now, to me, it was just bean soup. I was eating out of curiosity. I didn't have enough knowledge to fully appreciate the distinctions that were being made. So I wasn't going there as a pilgrim. I was going there as a tourist. I could definitely tell that some of the other eaters were there as pilgrims because they were eating very carefully. They were tasting very carefully, and they were experiencing this on a much deeper level than just eating some bean soup.
What is the difference then between a food tourist and a food pilgrim?
A food tourist tends to be primarily motivated by curiosity about a food, whereas a food pilgrim is very knowledgeable. There's a sense of seeking the sacred and seeking the authentic, but authenticity also tends to mean that it's unmediated by marketing concerns or by trying to adjust taste to different audiences.
Why is it that people seek this out? Why do you think people develop these obsessions for particular foods or restaurants?
That's where looking at this as a food pilgrimage, I think, is helpful. Technically, pilgrimages were journeys that were assigned by the church to people to atone for something. And at the end of their pilgrimage, they were then transformed back into an innocent person. They atoned for their transgressions. Now, I'm not saying that food pilgrims today are trying to atone for any transgressions, but they are seeking some kind of a transformation.
But can you be transformed through that experience? Does that offer them transformation, do you think?
I think it's possible. When you eat food in the context in which that food developed, you start understanding the logic of it. You start understanding why certain choices were made for ingredients or certain preparation methods. You start seeing what that food means to the people in that particular context. You're able to gain a fuller understanding of the food as an aesthetic form, but you also are able to experience as a cultural form, so that it's not just about the taste, it's about the meanings that are being given to it by the people who developed it.
Is there anything wrong with the way that the tourism industry uses people's interest in food, do you think? Is it to be encouraged, these long journeys across the world to experience local cuisine?
Well, food tourism that is done without sensitivity can have massively harmful effects on a food culture, on the host community, the economy, the local environment. So frequently, the tourism industry, in order to attract food tourists, focuses on finding dishes or ingredients or ways of eating that are very different and considered very exotic, that frequently then exoticizes the whole culture. It takes foods that are not necessarily the most representative foods of a culture, but because it's different for the tourist, that's the food that's highlighted. A good example of that is you go to Peru and have llama meat. It is something that is eaten occasionally in Peru, but the restaurants that are catering to tourists is featured on their menu. You know, so now people are thinking, oh, okay, the national food of Peru is llama.
Does this have economic effects when one food is emphasized above another for tourism?
Yes, yes. It can end up changing the local economy. If there's a food that is generally used just for celebrations, for example, and now there's much more of a market for it, you know, then farmers end up shifting from growing one food to another, producing that food just for the tourism market. And then it shifts the whole economic commodity chain in that way. It can also have massive environmental impacts if local farmers are going into monocropping, you know, raising only that one thing. That can be very, very bad for the environment. Overfishing happens, over-harvesting of things, you know, just for the tourism market.
So there can be irresponsible food tourism, but can there be irresponsible food pilgrimages?
Probably, yes.
So how to be a responsible food pilgrim or a responsible food tourist?
I think, first of all, recognition of the complexity of food, that food itself carries people's identities, it carries their histories. So if you're consuming a food purely for its aesthetic qualities, that's fine. You know, but when it comes to then creating a market and emphasizing that particular food over others, we need to be aware that these are identities that are being traded off.
Lucy Long is director of the Center for Food and Culture. Emily Thomas is the host of the BBC's The Food Chain. Now, I love that idea, the food traveler and the food pilgrim, because it's fascinating to think about what draws those pilgrims to having such deep connections to particular foods. But you know, what I also really liked is how Dr. Long isn't really about judging people for being one and not the other. It's just about recognizing that we always have some level of responsibility when we're eating other people's food. Like, the thing about people thinking llama meat is the national food of Peru sounds kind of funny at first, but, you know, it's one thing to be interested in the unique elements of a cuisine and another to fixate on those things and to end up making the people of that cuisine seem cartoonish or alien, like how dog eaters is basically a racial slur against Asians. And I was really struck by the way that Dr. Long talked about how travelers can influence the market for the foods of a culture. Now, have you ever heard the story of how acai became this huge health food thing in America? It basically goes like this. There were a couple surfer dudes from California who vacationed in Brazil. They were introduced to acai as a local food, and they started a company to export it back to the U.S. They made a ton of money, and lo and behold, the value of acai skyrocketed. So much that many of the local people in Brazil couldn't afford to eat their own staple food anymore. And quinoa is another example of that. So, you know, I'm not here to say if that's right or wrong because it's complicated, right? Like, on one hand, you have the jobs that a new industry creates, and on the other, you know, you have people who can't afford to eat the food they grew up on. And you have the things that people can now sell for money, and you have the idea that maybe not everything should be for sale. But I guess what I'm saying is, it's on us. If we're the tourists and the travelers and the pilgrims, it's on us to remember that when we travel, we're guests in someone else's culture. Because a culture is like a home, and even as customers, we're still in someone else's home. Navigating food cultures, that's what this episode's really all about. And later on, we're talking with a Moroccan chef who's inspired by Mexican cuisine. And
we're always celebrating all of these world records, the tallest building, the largest mall, the most expensive cupcake. At some point, we have the world's largest doner kebab. But for me, the record that we are breaking and the one that we often don't celebrate is the fact that we bring together the most number of cultures from the old world, from the Middle East, from the Indian subcontinent, Central Asia, North Africa, increasingly from East Asia. We are, in that sense, the modern day replay of the Silk Roads right in the safe haven of a city sitting, you know, right in the Middle East.
Tourism in Dubai. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. When we started this episode, we talked about the responsibilities that come with culinary tourism and how it can be tricky to balance consuming a culture with respecting it. But we also wanted to talk to someone who totally believes in using culinary tourism to show off her home. Now, you may think of Dubai as just like the most wildly opulent place in the world, a city in the desert with both indoor tropical rainforests and ski slopes. But there's a fascinating and important other side to it. Old Dubai, where migrants and refugees from all over the Middle East and beyond have come for safety or opportunity. And our next guest, Arva Ahmed, was raised there by parents who came from India and is passionate about leading food tours in her hometown as a way to tell stories while making you salivate. So hi, Arva. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So I know you lead food tours through the city for, I'm assuming, primarily international travelers and guests. What tends to surprise them when you take them around?
You'd be surprised, actually, that we take a lot of residents in Dubai on our tours as well. Yeah, we have quite a few because people live off in their own neighborhood. They're not coming back to the old side of town, which is where I've grown up and where I live. So there's this sort of disconnect between the two sides of town, both of which are very authentic, mind you. The tallest building, having the world's most expensive cupcake or cocktail or whatever you're having, sitting up on the nth floor of the best building in the world. I mean, that's very Dubai. That is Dubai. That luxurious experience is Dubai. But at the same time, the side of town that I live in is also extremely authentic. And to your question about what surprises people, as you mentioned, people see Dubai as this very modern, sleek, luxurious destination. It's sort of this artificial Disneyland of sorts in the region. And they don't expect that you have all of these layers of culture that are stacked up in the communities here. So I always, when people come on our experiences, we make it a point to not just feed them, but we use all of the different communities and the cultures, and specifically the plates that are coming out, we use them to talk about food history and culture in the region. It's a statement not just about the diversity of Dubai, but about how important food history and culture is in the broader region. And we can do that in Dubai. We are the place that, for example, brings together foods of even cultures in conflict. You might not be able to travel, for example, to Iraq right now. You may not be able to travel to Syria. You may not be able to travel to Afghanistan. But just sitting from where I am right now, I could go out and have those meals in, you know, within a 15-minute driving radius. And that, to me, is fantastic.
So if we were to go out with you, looking out your window in whatever direction you want to take us in, what are some of those neighborhoods and who would we meet there and what would we eat there?
The neighborhood that I've lived in, and I've lived here since 1989, this neighborhood used to be primarily Middle Eastern. So a lot of people from Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, Iraq, and so on. And so a lot of the restaurants have that very Middle Eastern focus. So for example, we could go one street down and we could have Palestinian-style stuffed falafels, and they're stuffed with
chili paste, which we call shatta. They're stuffed with sumac, which is the sour berry. It tastes very much like lemons. And they make it in a handmade sort of like a mold, sort of like an ice cream scoop, but for falafels. They crust it up with sesame seeds and deep fry it. And even the hummus is different, because typically you just serve your chickpeas and tahine, but the way the Palestinians and the Jordanians do it is they splash this spicy sauce over it. It's more sort of pungent, I guess, than spicy. It's green bell peppers, few chili peppers, lemon juice, and garlic almost blitzed together like a salsa verde, and they just splash it over the hummus, and it kicks up the whole flavor level a notch. So you can have Palestinian food. You can go down the street and have Iraqi food just steps away from that, which means you can have the 45-minute smoked, we call it maskouf. Maskouf is a kind of, it's a bottom feeder. It's a fish that typically in other parts of the world you would either disregard. I believe in Australia they convert it into Charlie the fertilizer. But it's a really ancient, it's an ancient cooking technique of cutting this massive fish. The minimum weight is about 2 kilograms, and you slice it open. Okay. It has to be done in a really certain way. Slow cook it around a wood fire for about 45 minutes, and then you scoop it up with fresh bread out of the tanur oven with mango pickle called amba, tomatoes, a kind of basil leaf that we call rehan, and onions, and it is simply delicious. That's just... These are walking distance from where I stay now. You cross the creek, you go to the other side, and then you land up in India Town. You land up in Meena Bazaar. And that's actually got a lot of really old restaurants, some of which have even been around before the country became a country in 1971. And you can have a mix of North Indian style street food. You can have dosas and idlis and vadas from South India. So really, it's this meze of cultures that's just waiting to be tasted.
And I'm really fascinated by what you said before, especially with the people who are coming from, you know, places where there's conflict. And they didn't necessarily even leave because they wanted to go somewhere else. They left because they had to. And I would imagine that impulse to hold on to what they could remember is intense.
And I completely agree. We don't just have people opening restaurants. There are cookbook authors here who feel compelled to write about their recipes, but the stories behind the recipes, because some of these dishes, they don't taste the same, not because of the ingredients, but because you didn't have the background behind where that dish was originally eaten, why it was eaten, how it was meant to be eaten. All of that really adds to the flavor behind the dish, because nostalgia is that, you know, it's that X factor. It's that flavor component that you just can't replicate. And I think a lot of people feel now this need to start showcasing some of the specialty dishes. When I was growing up, it was a lot of the standard Lebanese, but commercial Lebanese. So falafel, hummus, shawarma. You had your basic Indian restaurants, a lot of cafeterias doing juices and shawarmas. At that time, we didn't have the nuanced food culture that Dubai has currently. Over time, people have developed this appetite to want to learn. They want to experiment. They want to move past the hummus and the falafels. And they want to start learning about, you know, the special Palestinian chicken pie called musakhan, or the Syrian fateh, which is this beautiful crumbled dish with warm yogurt and butter and pine nuts and pomegranate seeds. There is an appetite to want to start discovering what are those authentic flavors in whatever form that it is replayed today. And I also see some really interesting innovations happening that I think maybe would not be accepted back in their home cultures. So for example, there's a baker down my street who mixes three ingredients that I'm quite positive are not meant to be mixed together, because I've had people from the Middle East coming on my tour and they feel appalled that you would mix ful medammis, which is the slow-cooked fava beans done Egyptian style, with chili paste, which is shatta, and labneh, which is hung yogurt, in one fatayer, which is sort of like a calzone pastry. You would never do that.
That sounds
incredible. That is not something, just, yeah, you've broken all kinds of rules. That is blasphemous. And I have found those same people who say that it's blasphemous, I found them lurking around on my streets coming back for exactly that. So in some cases, I think it's good to break a few rules. You kind of push your boundaries and you start blending ingredients. And isn't that actually how the world evolves and continues to evolve to begin with?
Yeah, especially there. You're in a new place. You're living a new life. You got to make your new pastries.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much, Arva. This has been really, really edifying. This has been really, really exciting to listen to.
Thank you. It was such an honor to have to speak with you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Arva Ahmed operates Frying Pan Adventures in Dubai.
And at home, you can try out some flavors from the Middle East with this recipe, savory Middle East flatbread from our friend Dina Sussman. It's a kind of tomato and ground lamb pizza. It's delicious. Find it at splendidtable.org. Murad Lalu came to America from Morocco, not to work in restaurants, but to study economics, until he missed the taste of his food so much that he decided to become a chef. And in his restaurants, he makes beautiful versions of Moroccan food, like, on one hand, traditional hand-rolled couscous, or you can have modern jet black aerated smoked eggplant purees. Now he and his chef Luis Maldonado are opening a new restaurant where the food is a mix of Moroccan and Mexican flavors. Can you imagine? Murad, Luis, so great to have you.
Thanks for having us, man.
Thank you.
So Murad, okay, to be honest, if someone said to me, hey, let's go check out this new Moroccan Mexican restaurant, like out of the blue, I would have been like, say what? Like, that sounds kind of bananas.
Exactly.
But you don't think it sounds bananas.
Not at all. I mean, when we first start talking about this project, it did not just come about because we were trying to do something gimmicky or something like cute. This whole thing started even before Luis came to work with me at Aziza, when I was working with my staff in the kitchen, and they were all from Guatemala and from the Yucatan. And when we would make stuff that is extremely Moroccan, it's very traditional, they would have absolutely no problem recognizing the flavors, the spices, even the technique. And it was really a seamless kind of thing that we were watching day in and day out. And that's where the connection started. But it was reinforced when Luis starts working with me, and we were able to actually intellectually discuss these things and go to the bottom of it.
And what have you found, Luis?
I mean, just conceiving dishes, I mean, from my standpoint, looking at it from the outside was just seeing the similarities between both cuisines. I see the food and everything else as from an American, from the Western standpoint. So I don't necessarily know the traditional stuff. So I'm seeing it from the Moroccan lens. And then as I'm studying Mexican cuisine, it's kind of doing the influences with that.
And what are some of the combinations and some of the commonalities between the cuisines that you've found and that you want to work with?
Well, basically, if you really look at it, as you said at the beginning, if you told somebody we're going to mix Mexican food and Moorish food, it sounds silly. But the more you look into it, the more you see that there's a huge connection between how it happened when the Moors invaded Southern Europe. And basically in 711, they invaded Spain and Portugal. And they set up there for about 800 years. And literally, the influence of the Moors with all the spices, the cuisine, the architecture, the music, everything was basically put in place in Spain and in Portugal. Yeah. And, you know, surprisingly enough, the same year they were kicked out of Spain, that's the same year that Christopher Columbus discovered America. And he brought with him a lot of the Moors that were captive. They were slaves. So when the Moors were defeated, some of them were enslaved, and basically they were brought to the New World to work and cultivate the ground and farm and do all those things that needed to be done. So the connection is there, and you can see it in the food in Mexico. You can see it even today. One of the examples that I can think of is there's a dish in Mexico called Moros y Cristianos, which is the Moors and the Christians. And basically it's a dish that has rice and black beans.
Yeah, white rice and black beans.
Yeah. So the rice was brought in by the Spanish, and the Spanish got it from the Moors. And obviously the black beans is something that was cultivated in Latin America. So they put together this dish that is beautiful and tasty and simple, and it exemplifies the two cultures together.
Yeah, it's funny too, because I think one of my favorite tacos is tacos al pastor, right? And, you know, if you look at the way they make it, it's a trompo. So it's basically a rotating rotisserie of all these slices of pork that are stacked up into this sort of like this cone of meat that they just, you know, that they roast in a rotisserie and keep slicing off. It's delicious. It's amazing. And it looks exactly like shawarma. And that, I understood.
It's a gyro.
Yeah, like, it's
just
a gyro,
like,
right?
Make it, it's a gyro. You know, there's no doubt about it. It happened exactly when the Spanish went to the New World. And it's basically, it's the idea of roasting meat that is stacked up like that, you know, in a vertical manner, that is totally Middle Eastern. And to put it on a tortilla, instead of the pita, and it has the, you know, the yogurt sauce, and it has the, you know, it's a gyro. It's yeah. a gyro. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that happened more recently. I think that was like Lebanese immigrants into Mexico. But like, yeah, but like there are so many flavor similarities that really connect. So as you're exploring the menu you want to do in this new restaurant, what are some of the flavors that you want to play with? What are some of the things that you think will be important in your cooking?
Pretty much what we want to do, as you said, like the Al Pastor is something that is really unique. It's very well known. It's famous. But we're going to take it a step back and do our own interpretations of what it means when it first happened. We will go back and we will examine the dish, dissect it and understand it and try to come up with a version of it that makes sense to us. Louis, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of developing the new dishes, it's also looking at either classic Mexican or classic Moroccan dishes too, and just trying to compare the two. I mean, if you look at like your classic mole, it's going to have nuts or seeds. It's going to have some sort of dried fruit component, obviously the chilies. And then you look back at Moroccan cuisine with the dried fruit, the nuts, and then put the two together. I mean, we're kind of writing it as we go, but the flavors between the two always work really, really well together.
I do believe that one of the things that Moroccan food does better than most cuisines is marrying the sweet and the savory. And the first time I heard of mole and I tasted it, I really felt like it reminded me a lot of Moroccan food. You know, they were able to take something that is sweet, something that is savory, and combine it into an iconic dish. And to me, that was a light bulb moment. And I realized that there were so many similarities between the two cuisines.
So as you're experimenting right now, and you're looking into your research and getting inspired, what are you playing with? Like, what would we taste if we were walking to your test kitchen today?
Definitely right now, it's defining what our mole is going to be. I mean, we have to have a mole. So right now, we're working on an assortment of chilies. We're infusing the steeping water with rose, prunes, just those, you know, preserved lemon. So you get the undertones of it, but at the end of the day, you get the sesame seed, the pomegranate molasses, and then we'll put pumpkin seeds, the burnt onions, and garlic. So we're really trying to, kind of, I mean, like I said, write it as we go, but the mole is the first one is to bring the two together.
Right. Well, this is fascinating. I can't wait to see what you guys come up with.
Well, we look forward to having you, man.
Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Francis, for having us.
Murad Lalu is the chef owner of Murad Restaurant in San Francisco, and Luis Maldonado will lead the kitchen of the soon-to-open restaurant Amara. And you can find a great recipe for tacos al pastor from Alex Stupak on our website, splendidtable.org. I kind of have to admit that when I was talking with Murad and Luis, that I got a little distracted by the tacos al pastor. I mean, I love them so much. And I'm fascinated by their history as a kind of Lebanese-Mexican hybrid. And apparently, in parts of Mexico, you can get them as tacos árabes, Arabic tacos, and they're served on pita bread. But then the pita got me thinking, what's up with flour tortillas? A few shows back, we had a guest, Jorge Gaviria, who is a corn tortilla evangelist. And hearing him talk got me more excited about corn tortillas than, like, how I feel about my own daughter learning to say my name. And since then, flour tortillas have nearly lost all my love. And apparently, they don't get much love from Mexicans either. But the taco historian Gustavo Arellano thinks we should be giving them a second look. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Francis.
So you used to write a column called Ask a Mexican. So now I want to ask a Mexican. How do most Mexicans feel about flour tortillas?
In Mexico, most Mexicans don't even have an opinion about flour tortillas because they're historically situated in northern Mexico and really in the borderland, so right on the U.S.-Mexico border. As a result, historically, northern Mexico has always been considered a land apart, la tierra de los salvajes, the land of the savages. So that's in Mexico. And then, of course, in the United States, you know, the great Mexican food evangelists, they see flour tortillas as a gabacho, that is to say, a white appropriation of Mexican food, which is totally not the case.
So why is it not the case? Because, like, you know, when I think of flour tortillas, I think of, frankly, Taco Bell, you know, that kind of thing, this very commodified version of Mexican food. So, but it's not exactly that.
No, because you have never had a good flour tortilla in your life. That's why you think. Most people who think of flour tortillas as commodified, you're right. I wouldn't even say Taco Bell anymore. I would say most people who know flour tortillas now know the Chipotle model, which is mass-produced. And it's funny because Chipotle, historically, they've always liked to promote their organic, fair trade, humanely raised. They sure as hell don't do that with flour tortillas. So what I would tell those people, first of all, flour tortillas are Mexican. They are eaten in northern Mexico, which last I checked was a part of Mexico. They are eaten on the borderlands, which 150 years ago was still Mexico. And more importantly, to this day, they're eaten by millions of Mexican Americans in the United States, all with their own unique traditions. And so anyone who hates on flour tortillas, that's what I would say again. You have not eaten a good flour tortilla.
So let's talk about the universe of good flour tortillas. You say they're parts of different kinds of Mexican traditions. Are they regional? Are there different styles?
Absolutely. And the taxonomy that I use isn't Mexico itself, because obviously to get those tortillas, you're going to have to go down to Mexico. But here in the United States, you could easily get them if you follow this manner. So in Texas, the style of tortilla that you're talking about is the classic Tex-Mex tortilla. So it's thick, it's chewy, it's almost like a biscuit, because the Texans, or los Tejanos, they actually use baking powder in it. It's just a tradition. And the telltale sign is when they start puffing up on the comal, on the griddle, they get big, almost like sometimes they could get as big as a roti, like that Indian flatbread as well.
Oh, wow.
Then you move over to New Mexico. New Mexico, it tends to be a little bit forgotten in the great flour tortilla wars between Texas and Arizona. But I like New Mexico style of flour tortillas because they're a little bit less thick than the Texas type, but they're also wheatier. In New Mexico, when they get their flour tortillas, they're using the wheat from New Mexico. So in that sense, it's very regional. But for me and a lot of people, the king of the flour tortilla is going to be the Sonoran style tortilla. So even in Arizona, what people would call Arizona Mexican cuisine, back there, they call it just Sonoran cuisine. So this is where you get flour tortillas as thin as a napkin, translucent and buttery and just amazing. They're so pliable. They could be as small as your hand or as big as a forearm. The famous tortillas of Sonora that are the super big ones, they're called sobaqueras. Colloquially, they're called sobaqueras, which basically means armpitters, because they're as big as putting it from your hand all the way to your armpit.
That's so poetic.
That's the colloquial name. Yeah, sorry.
But that's huge. Like, I don't know how much food you would put in that tortilla. But okay, so let me ask you this. Like, I'm curious about the history of the flour tortilla. And so earlier we talked to two chefs who were looking into the Moorish influence of Mexican food. I think primarily through the fact that the Moors conquered Spain and they ruled Spain for 800 years right before Spain came to the New World. And so there's going to be a lot of Moorish influence in that Spanish culture that came to the New World. And this is maybe goofy, and I'm probably totally wrong, but is it possible that there's a link between pita, or like Moorish flatbreads, and the flour tortilla?
There has to be, from the Levantine, right? And depending on the decade, sometimes people say it's a Jewish influence. Sometimes people say it's a Moorish influence. The reality is no one really knows how flour tortillas got started in Mexico, except that it was done, again, up in northern Mexico. But here's the key about northern Mexico. You have to imagine, we're talking about the 1500s, the 1600s, where the country of Mexico is still being, frankly, conquered by the Spaniards, and the Spaniards are sending people off to go off and basically subjugate tribes. A lot of the people who wanted to go to the most northern outreaches, we're talking about New Mexico, Chihuahua, and all that, these are people who in Spain themselves were already quote-unquote mongrels. They were undesirable. So you're getting a lot of people who are Jews, hidden Jews, mind you, because we're still in the Inquisition, and you're also going to get Muslims as well, Moros. So they're going up there, and they're going to use whatever they can to be able to recreate not just the foods of the quote-unquote Spaniards, but also their native cuisine. So yeah, I mean, I would even say the tortilla is like a pita. I would call it almost more like a lavash, like a Persian flatbread. I remember the first time I went to a Persian restaurant, here I have this big, rice pilaf, and you're getting, fesanjoon, the great walnut stew that I personally think looks like a mole, and here I'm expecting this pita bread. Nope, they give me big squares of lavash. And I'm thinking to myself, are they Mexican or something? Because this looks exactly like a flour tortilla.
Oh, that's fascinating. God, the world is so big, but sometimes it's so small.
I love it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Gustavo. This is fascinating.
No, gracias.
Gustavo Arellano is the author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America. And you can read his article on flour tortillas at newyorker.com. And coming up, America's Test Kitchen with their take on the famous spicy cheese bread of the Madison, Wisconsin Farmers Market. And I get to talk to you. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. All right, and now we get to talk to each other. Get to us any way you like, 1-800-537-5252, or you can find us on the interwebs at Facebook or at Twitter, or you can email us, contact@splendidtable.org. And we have Kenzie calling. Hi, Kenzie, how are you?
Hi, Francis, I'm great, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Dublin, Ireland.
Dublin, Ireland? Oh, that's awesome.
Yep.
This is a real... Wait, what time? Is it like some insane time for you right now? Or is it like a totally... Oh, no, it's like probably...
No,
like...
actually, we're only 5 hours out of you.
Okay. Anyway, so what would you like to talk about?
Well, I was... I tweeted the Splendid Table about Irish stew. My coworker, who is Irish here, recommended to me that I should use sirloin steak for an Irish stew. And my partner, who's Irish, never went back. He refuses to eat a different kind of stew now. And I was making it the other week, and unfortunately, my typical kind of heavy bottom pot for the stew had chipped, so I was no longer able to use it, and I had to use a sterling silver one. And that meant that the bottom burnt really quickly, and then the burnt flavor kind of came into the stew. But then I thought, oh man, I have a kilo of sirloin steak in that. What do I do with it? So I wondered if you had any suggestions.
Oi. Okay, so the stew is done, right? It's cooked, and it's tasting a little toasty. Okay. Well, I'm really sorry about your pot.
Thank you.
Okay, so I have to confess to you, I have never made Irish stew, and I don't really know what's in it. So what are the flavors in your Irish stew? So let me help you think about how to fix.
Well, it's a Guinness stew. Basically, the base is the base of any stew. You have carrots, you have celery, and you have onion. And you saute the onion, you add some flour, and then you add a full can of Guinness. So it's like a full pint of Guinness. And then you reduce that down, add in 4 tablespoons of tomato paste, all your veg, all your meat, which you've sauteed prior, so it's nice and brown. And then you just let that stew for a few hours with some fresh thyme. And you serve that with like what they call here crusty bread. I know it's a horrible name, but it's just bread with a nice crust on it.
Crusty bread sounds fabulous.
Yeah, crusty bread and mash, good mash. And that's your Irish stew.
Yeah. So basically we're talking about the main flavors are going to be this really nice cooked out reduced Guinness. So a nice stout, it's going to be chocolatey. It's going to already sort of have like a dark, sort of a dark roasty flavor from that beer. You have some of the tomato paste. It doesn't sound like a whole ton of it. So that'll give you a little bit of tartness and some sweetness and just kind of more depth. Okay, so if I were to say, if it's like a light scorch, like, you know, you got a little bit burnt, you kind of taste it, it's a little bit sort of carbony, metallic-y flavor, it's just not super pleasant. I would say to think about a couple things. You'll probably end up changing the typical flavor profile of the stew, but this is just to like help salvage and make it tasty, if not taste like normal, you know what I mean? I don't think you can take that flavor out of it, but you can maybe add things to it that'll kind of help harmonize with it and blend it a little bit. I would think in your case, maybe adding a little bit more tomato and maybe even a splash of vinegar and cooking that. So you bring some of the acidity and some of the higher notes. And sometimes that helps sort of distract you from the bitterness, to be honest. It'll lighten the dish a bit. It'll like brighten it a little bit. I would cook it for a little bit so it's not like raw tasting in there, but just to start pulling that flavor up. You know what I mean? If you think of like a deep, dark flavor as being heavy and deep, and you think of like, you know, a bright thing like a tomato or an acidity or a vinegar as being light, you want to sort of pull the flavor, the average flavor of it a little bit up, if that makes any sense at all.
And then
I would also, I would think about maybe adding a little bit of sugar, help balance the acidity. And you're in Ireland, you have like some of the greatest butter in the universe. I would throw in some butter.
That's when it's very true, actually.
Yeah, you know, like when the stew is like warm, I would stir in some cold butter until it sort of like blends into the stew. Not, you don't want like a slick of fat on top, and that'll help smooth out a lot of the other flavors.
Okay.
But I gotta be honest with you, if it's like really burnt, like if you walked away, like you took your dog on a walk, and like, you know, you like went to a cafe and started reading like James Joyce and came back after, you know, 20 pages of Finnegan's Wake kind of burnt, you might be out of luck.
No, it's definitely the first kind of burnt, although unfortunately it made me lose the second pot. But yes, at least the stew is still there.
Yeah. And if all else fails, honestly, and you have all that nice meat in there, I would think by just taking the meat out, and like, this is pretty janky, but it's better than throwing it out. If the broth is too burnt, I would maybe think about taking the meat out and like rinsing it, in water. And then you can maybe like do something else with it.
Shred it. Yeah.
Yeah, you can shred it and, you know, season it with something else and go from there.
Fantastic.
Okay. Cool. Well, I hope it helps.
Well, thank you, Francis.
Thank you so much for the call and from calling from so far away.
Not at all. Thank you for having me. Have a lovely day.
All right. Take care. You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. We have Lauren on the line. Hey, Lauren, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Boise, Idaho.
Oh, very nice. And what would you like to talk about?
My husband and I recently went on a vacation to Crete. We were there over the winter holidays, and it was amazing and life-changing. Mm. And one of the amazing life-changing foods we ate, because everything, of course, was incredible.
Your life changed twice, at least.
Like, several times. The food on Crete is just so outstanding.
I can only imagine.
I was really sad to have to come back. But one of the things that we ate was this really delicious feta cheese. And it was like you would get normally here in a block, but when you bit into it, it was like creamy.
Mm.
Like a fromage chèvre texture when you bit in. And so I'm wondering, first of all, what makes it so different? And two, how can I make that?
Well, do you make a lot of cheese? Like
an
amateur cheesemaker?
No, I wish I was. I'm an aspiring amateur cheesemaker.
Okay, well, I'm not a cheesemaker either, so this is great. We're in the same boat. I think, though, the difference is probably how hard it was pressed. So when you make cheese, you take the milk, right? The basic process of making cheese is you take the milk, you heat it, you add some kind of curdling agent, maybe it's rennet, or in some cases it might be like an acid, a lemon juice or something like that, and you cook it so all the milk proteins will solidify. And cheesemakers will, you know, lift that curd and, you know, you start to press it to get more of that extra moisture out. And I think what happens with a really creamy feta is it's not pressed quite as hard, so it retains some of its moisture. And I think the thing with feta, too, is you then take that block of cheese and you brine it. And I think it's possible that the creamier fetas maybe are not brined as long either. I don't know that for a fact, but I can imagine if it's like, oh, the salt will continue to firm up the proteins or something like that. So maybe that. I assume it's just a little bit less pressed out and maybe brined a little bit less, or maybe brined in a less saline solution. But I'm just speculating here. That said, you can find nice creamy fetas here in the States as well. Like, you might need to go to a specialty shop, but I've definitely had French fetas that have been creamy and beautiful and delicious. I really love that texture, like you said. It's not like the hard, sort of just salty blocks.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool. Well, I'm glad to hear that you had life-changing feta cheese, because not everyone gets to say that.
It's so great. It's amazing to be on an island where literally everything comes from there. And like driving around greenhouses everywhere with bananas and all kinds of fruit. Olives, of course, in every tiny nook and cranny you could possibly fit an olive tree, they had olives.
Oh, wow.
It was incredible.
Why'd you go there? Why'd you pick that place?
My in-laws decided when they retired that the best way to spend their retirement was live everywhere. So they spend several months in different places all over the world. Last Christmas, we were in Cozumel. This past Christmas, we were in Crete.
They're just working their way down the alphabet? Like,
kind of, yeah. They've been all sorts of places. Last year, they did Sardinia. They did Ireland and Scotland. I mean, it's amazing what you can do. with long-term rentals and a good pension.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for the call, and thank you for making me jealous.
Oh, thank you very much for helping me out.
Take care, Lauren. Bye-bye. And you, too, can call us anytime you want. 1-800-537-5252. Leave us a voicemail. Let us know your likes, your dislikes, your sign, what you're curious about, anything. We listen to those voicemails when we're lonely and when we're at work. We started this episode talking about the regional beans of Spain, and we'll finish it with one of the regional breads of the Great Midwest. Madison, Wisconsin, to be exact, where pilgrimages are made every weekend for the spicy cheese bread sold at the farmer's market. Our producer Sally Swift talked with Tucker Shaw of America's Test Kitchen about this classic.
Hey, Tucker.
Hi, Sally.
You know, I have been thinking about farmers markets lately, and there is one in Madison, Wisconsin that is just so beautiful. It surrounds the Capitol. It's been there for years and years and years. People are just, you know, rabidly attached to it. And I have heard that one of the things that people buy all the time in that market is this cheese bread. And you guys have done a little work on it.
It's true, yeah. I mean, you know, like with many farmers markets, you know, thousands of people will go every week to kind of, you know, look over the tomatoes and look over the lettuce. But they line up for this cheese bread in Madison, Wisconsin. And our food editor paid a visit to the Dane County Farmers Market a couple of years ago. And he brought back these stories of this spicy cheese bread that's served by Stella's Bakery, who sets up a stall at the farmer's market. And just hearing him talk about it, we knew it was something that we had to investigate a little bit more deeply.
I am quite certain I have never had good cheese bread. So tell me what you guys did to duplicate this recipe. What's the key?
So what this bread looks like, it's sort of a big round loaf. And it's got, like, rather than grated cheese that's baked into it, it's kind of got these pockets of cheese so that when the bread is warm, you pull it apart and you get these really melty, oozy, just gorgeous bits. And it also comes with a really healthy dose of red pepper flakes. So you also get this like spiky spiciness that just makes you want to take another bite. And we thought, you know, this is great if you're in Wisconsin, but this kind of experience should be shared with the rest of the country. So as we often do in Cook's Country, we take inspiration from this original recipe and then find a way not to exactly duplicate it, but to get something that is inspired by it and sort of hits all the same buttons.
Huh. Okay. So what do we need to do?
So this is a great bread if you're not an experienced bread maker. And we've found that, you know, we published this a couple of years ago, but it's really, really taken on a life of its own. And people still talk about this bread. It's a very simple dough to work with. It's very similar to like a challah dough. So it's rather soft. Mm-hmm. You basically take flour, sugar, yeast, and salt, some warm water, eggs, and butter, and you stick it in your stand mixer and you let the stand mixer do the kneading work for you. You have to leave it in there, you know, kind of kneading away for 8 or 10 minutes or something like that.
I'm surprised by the sweet part.
Yeah, it's not too much sugar, but it's just enough to kind of give it a little bit of sweetness would almost be hard to detect when you eat it, but it does kind of even things out a little bit.
Okay.
So you've kneaded your bread, you put it into a greased bowl, and of course, as with any bread, you've got to walk away for an hour and a half or so and let it rise. And then you're going to take it out and you're going to roll it into a rectangle and kind of punch it down. And this will help sort of release some of the air that's come in there because you don't want huge air pockets in this bread. You want a fairly close structure so that it will hold on to the cheese that you are about to add. So you've rolled this out into a rectangle and you sprinkle over the top cubes of provolone and Monterey Jack cheese. And, you know, a good spoonful of red pepper flakes. Hmm. You then take this rectangle and roll it into a log. And then you spiral it into a cake pan. And the cake pan is the key to holding this beautiful round spiraled shape. And the dough will rise in this cake pan and then also bake in this cake pan. So once you've spiraled it in there, you don't have to take it out again until it's finished and ready to eat.
And you just pop that right in the oven.
That's right.
Wow, it sounds great. And I can just imagine that toasted.
It's so good. I mean, like,
I bet it's
first of all, if you have any left over, which depending on how many people are in your house is unlikely, when you slice this the next day and toast it in the oven, I'm not sure I would put it in the toaster, depending on how much you love your toaster.
Right.
But it's almost like a self-contained grilled cheese sandwich. You know what I mean? You've got the cheese, you've got toasty bread. It's all ready to go for you. It's so good. And if you haven't baked bread before, please do this because you will fancy yourself a bread baker after you achieve this loaf.
Sounds like a great entry-level recipe in many ways. Hey, and so the next time I want to talk to you about another cheese bread, Kachiapuri. Do you know Kachiapuri from Georgia?
No, but I like the sound of this already. You mean Georgia, America, or Georgia, Asia?
Georgia, the country. Yep. And you dig in and take a look, and let me tell you, that is a cheese bread.
Listen, you put cheese and bread in the same phrase, I'm sold.
Thanks, Tucker.
Thank you, Sally.
Tucker Shaw is the editor of Cook's Country. And if you're ever, like, within 300 miles, you should totally go to the Madison, Wisconsin Farmers Market. It is such a beautiful, beautiful market. And, you know, don't tell anyone there, but you can make that bread at home. Find the recipe for spicy cheese bread at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And if you ever want more information on anything you heard here, go to splendidtable.org. You can register for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and subscribe to our podcast. And we have some news. We have a new baby, a mini podcast called Splendid Table Select. It posts twice a month and features interviews and stories that have inspired us or taught us something new or just made us better cooks. That's Splendid Table Select, and you can find it wherever you download your podcasts. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell and assistant producer Erica Romero. Jenny J. Lou Lupke is our editor and technical director and resident Scani. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. And special thanks this week to KUCI and Irvine for all their help. Thank you for tuning in, and I'm Francis Lamb. This is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.